Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. It's the 15th of January, and this is hour two of Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, with Rachel Sutton and Paul Perreault in studio. And Tuesday mornings at the second hour means that we're going to be joined for a story about kindness from our good friend, Nicole J. Phillips. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, although I'm filled with a bit of jealousy right now. I think you're causing me to stumble because I understand that you are at Disney World right now.
I am. I'm sitting in a condo at Old Key West at Disney World. But if it makes you feel any better, 2 days ago, my 8-year-old was vomiting, and this morning it is the 12-year-old.
So. Oh, no. That's the worst when you go on vacation like that, and then you're sort of stuck inside. There just isn't. You can kind of get out with a cold, but when it comes to stomach flu stuff, there's really just not a lot you can do.
I know. I'm counting the dollars we're losing right now. No, it's fine. It's fine.
Well, thanks for taking some time away from Disney World just to break in that to give us a story on kindness. I know it's always a very uplifting way in the midst of some of the troubling headlines that we have to deal with day in and day out. So what do you have for us this morning?
Well, I think it's important to remember that God created us for kindness. And we know that because these four feel-good chemicals are released into our bodies when we give, we receive, or we witness an act of kindness. And I got to witness a really great act of kindness with my kids the other day at a Disney park. And we were standing there buying a Mickey bar, and all of a sudden a group of about 20 people behind us yelled, "Thank you, Elizabeth." And the woman who was serving us at the kiosk just started beaming. She got teary-eyed, and I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "Well, I gave one of those guys a free Mickey bar earlier, and he went back and he got his group of 20 that he was traveling with, and they just came and surprised me to say thank you." She's like, "Wow, I've never had anything like that happen to me before." And you could just see it made her feel so special and so appreciated, and I loved being the witness of that. But then later on in the day, my kids and I saw her working in another kiosk, so we yelled, "Thank you, Elizabeth," and just to remind her that she was appreciated too by our much smaller group. But I think it's important to remember that there are people around us who are serving us in ways every day, and they don't want to be invisible. They want to be appreciated, and they certainly love it when they are.
Well, and you reference the chemicals that are released during moments of kindness like that. They really do end up having an impact on our memory and on our psyche moving forward, don't they?
They do, and they can cause you to age more slowly, and they can reduce blood pressure, and they give you these great feelings of this helper's high. And so it's true, and it's powerful, and it's the way God created us, and it's pretty awesome.
Well, thanks again for joining us as you do with these short stories of kindness. They really are uplifting, Nicole, and we will send our prayers to you on the Disney World campus for you and your family, and just that you'll get through the sickness quickly so you can enjoy the rest of the time there.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it, Peter.
If you want to see more stories from Nicole J. Phillips about kindness, she has some great books out there, and you can go to braveandkind.net to check all of those books out and some of the stories that she has. Well, up next, we'll be joined by Justin Gibney of the AND Campaign. And speaking of kindness, we sure could use some kindness in our politics. And Justin and I will talk about that next on Faith Radio Mornings.
God of mercy, sweet love of mine, I have surrendered to your design. May this offering stretch across the sky, these hallelujahs be more.
Just about 10 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we're joined at this time by Justin Gibney of the AND campaign. Justin's a regular contributor, not just to the morning show, but he's on the Faith Radio Network often talking about ways in which we can approach politics from a kingdom standpoint. Good morning, Justin.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Well, it's going pretty well. A little chilly, a little dark here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but, you know, the sun will come up. I'm assuming it'll – are you in Atlanta right now?
I am.
So did the sun come up already in Atlanta? You got to give me some measure of hope here, Justin.
Oh, yeah, it's shining bright.
I love it. Well, thanks for joining us. I know one of the topics that's top of the mind these days is obviously the ongoing rancor and the division in Washington, D.C. And you released an article titled Graceless Politics, in which you're inviting people to maybe think about a different way besides all the bluster and the back and forth power over kinds of dynamics that are part of Washington, D.C. Take our listeners through a bit of your thinking in this.
Yeah, well, as you stated, our politics right now are really hostile. And I think people are under the misconception that somehow hostility and acting toward, you know, uncivil and using different sorts of language is actually more effective than being more gracious. And so really what I argue in the article is that, especially for Christians, there is always a time for grace in these conversations. And in fact, grace is actually more effective. The incivility and the nastiness is actually a lot of times it's counterproductive.
And we see some of the invitations even from the biblical text, things like a gentle answer turns away wrath. And we see about Jesus saying things like bless those who curse you. Is there some of this that breaks the cycle, Justin? Because it calls to mind Martin Luther King Jr. talking with this great quote when he says, hate begets hate, violence begets violence, toughness begets a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love, or else we descend into a void that, or a darkness that's void of the stars. And I think about that I hardly ever know of a situation, whether it's in a friendship or in a marriage or in politics, in a business, anything, where you see some of this hate where it just ends anywhere good unless somebody's willing to break that cycle.
Yeah, hatred is infectious. And I think the civil rights movement taught us that, and we've seen it throughout history. We obviously see it in the Bible, that hate is infectious, and that instead of being a carrier of that hate, that we should try to change things. Now, I want to be clear. This doesn't mean that we let oppressors go, or we let people who are doing wrong go. That's not what this is saying at all. But in how we address it, because certain things have to be addressed, this is not saying that we should shy away from issues at all. But it's saying there is a certain way for Christians to address things. Ephesians 4:15 says we should speak the truth in love. And so as we tell the truth, as we address oppression and discrimination, where they may be, we have to do it in a certain way, and that should be with grace.
Well, and in terms of looking back to the 2015-2016 election cycle, agree or disagree with the president's policies, agree or disagree with policies and more the Democratic side of it, I think we can safely say that Donald Trump introduced something into the political atmosphere that was of a different degree and a different caliber in terms of sort of the nastiness. And you write in your article, Graceless Politics, that embracing the spirit of the commander-in-chief is perhaps overestimating what can be accomplished by responding to nastiness in kind. What I read on Twitter from our politicians these days, Justin, it makes my hair stand on end at sometimes, and we're certainly getting used to it a little bit in terms of the level of discourse.
Yeah, it seems that we value the witty comeback more than we do the solution. And so people want retweets. We want to see our leaders say something mean to humiliate the other side. But if we think about that, humiliating the other side is extremely counterproductive. Not only does it make it less likely that you'll be able to work with them to get something done, but all you're doing is making hardening the hearts of the people on your side as well. And so at the end of the day, well, I can have a serious conversation and call people out when necessary. To be focused on humiliating the other side and getting retweets because I had the strongest comeback while people are sitting at home and the government is closed and I haven't done anything to stop that, I think it's irresponsible, but I think it starts with us. It starts with the people. Politicians, a lot of them, let's just face it, they seek attention. And if we don't give them attention for those type of negative things, they may stop doing it. And so I would tell people, stop retweeting, stop chatting up or talking about those people who are trying to get attention through doing it the wrong way. talk about those people who are actually putting policy forth, who are, you know, really working on getting things done instead of those who are always talking. And, you know, a lot of our politicians are better commentators than they are policymakers, and that needs to stop.
Yeah, you make such an important point, because I think the greatest fear perhaps of any politician is not being in the news. And so regardless of whether you're in the news for positive or negative reasons, there's this desire to be in that news cycle.
Yeah, for sure. And it's sort of like my children, right? Children want attention. And so sometimes if they can get it through doing something positive, they'll do it that way. If they can get it through doing things that are negative, they'll get it that way, any way they can get it. And we need to treat it that way and say, no, we're not going to reward negative behavior or behavior that further damages our discourse.
Well, and one of the things that we can do, Justin, is look back and learn from the events of history when things were maybe effective as something that somebody did that really did change the trajectory. And you tell a great story from June of 1963 about a woman named Fannie Lou who really was helpful in changing some of the trajectory of the Jim Crow era.
Oh, yeah. Well, Fannie Lou Hamer is a civil rights legend, and I would recommend that everyone listening today go read up on Fannie Lou Hamer. We talk a lot about Dr. King, and especially in this month and the next couple of days, as we should. I'm actually reading a book on Dr. King as we right now. But Fannie Lou Hamer, in a lot of ways, really embodied the civil rights movement almost even more than Dr. King did, just through her life. And one of the things that she went through is that she was beaten. She was in the South kind of doing training to demystify the political process to Southern blacks who had never been able to vote, who had been disenfranchised. Well, in the midst of doing that, she was pulled over. She was beaten senselessly. And after all that happened, the police officer ended up getting off. She was actually fined for the incident, although she did nothing wrong. One of her friends asked her, what do you think about the people who did this to you? I mean, what do you have to say? And her response was, we have to pray for them. They're sick. And if we're going to be the physician, then we have to pray for them, and we kind of have to rise above what's happened. And that, I think, is the moral of the story when it comes to the civil rights movement. This didn't stop her from fighting. She fought and continued to fight the struggle day in and day out. But she knew that at the end of the day, as a Christian, she had to do it with grace, and that everyone was broken and everyone needed to be forgiven. That didn't mean they didn't need to be held accountable, but she did have to forgive. And I think that's a lesson we could all learn.
Yeah, I think it's such an important thing that you're suggesting, is that to offer grace and forgiveness does not mean we're not holding people responsible or a lack of accountability. And if somebody is a victim of injustice in any kind of situation, Justin, I would think a first blush response is to not respond in prayer. What's sort of required for a person to enter into that kind of character? It almost feels otherworldly in my mind.
It's completely otherworldly. It's not logical, and so we shouldn't expect a lot of other people to get it. But I think it is a matter of prayer. It's a matter of being as close to the cross and understanding the life of Jesus as much as possible to get to a place where you understand that the ultimate victory isn't here. The ultimate victory is beyond, and you are here, number one, not to win something, but you are here to have a witness that is worthy of, you know, of what the Father and doing the Father's business. And so at the end of the day, no, we don't just accept whatever goes down here. We try to do what we can do to make things better, to serve justice and to do justice. But we have to keep in mind that there are greater things than what's here on earth.
Yeah, such an important reminder. Boy, it's living out of a different kingdom, and that isn't always easy to do. We're talking with Justin Gibney this morning of the AND campaign, and we'll come back in just a minute, Justin. Some pretty troubling comments out of a congressman in Iowa, Steve King, that happened here recently, and I want to get your perspective on what he said about white supremacy here next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Cause no matter where I'm going, there's never been a moment.
21 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. We are talking with Justin Gibney of the AND campaign about ways in which we can inject maybe a bit of grace in our conversations in the political sphere. And Justin, some troubling comments coming out of a congressman out of Iowa here in the last few days, in which Steve King said these words. He said, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? Gee, Justin, it's hard to understand why that would be offensive.
Yeah, unfortunately, this isn't the first time Steve King has said things like this. And so I think it's incumbent, especially coming from a minority point of view, I think it's incumbent on Christians who are on the Republican side of the spectrum to really call this out. I mean, this is the time when you say, you know what? We have to make sure that we are clear that we do not condone this type of thing, because it's been going on for too long. And I'm glad some folks have stepped up and said something about it. But Steve King has been, very close to words like this many times before. And it's unfortunate that he's just getting called out now.
Yeah, and to your point, there is an accountability level that needs to be in place, even if we do and as we do respond in grace and love. And it was refreshing to see Mitt Romney say yesterday some things about holding him accountable.
Well, Steve King's comments are reprehensible. They have no place in polite society, certainly no place in the Republican Party, and they should have no place in the United States Congress. He ought to resign and move on and let someone else who represents American values take his seat.
And, of course, I think we can fairly say, Justin, that part of what motivates these sorts of comments is a recognition that the Republican Party is going to alienate a lot of people if they don't respond. But in the past, there hasn't been a lot of response that really condemns these kind of remarks.
Yeah, that's right, because I think there's an understanding that there is part of the base who doesn't have a problem with this. I mean, he said it for a reason. He probably said it because it ignites a certain group of people. And so this is when political calculations need to go out the window. When things like this happen, the reason that both sides get in trouble is because we have political calculations and we're thinking about who may be offended. If the only reason that we're saying something about this is because we may offend more people if we don't, then that's problematic. We should say something about it because it's wrong. And until we can get to that point, especially as Christians, because I can't speak to everyone else's values in the same way, especially as Christians, when it comes to principle, when it comes to people being treated fairly and basically human dignity, there should be no political calculation. We have to do what's right.
Well, and Justin, you work in the political sphere quite a bit throughout any given week, and I'm assuming that it would be refreshing if we would hear more kinds of comments that don't involve political calculation, but it does seem like everything is messaged, you know, time and time and time again before it ever gets out into public.
Oh, absolutely, and as being a political strategist, I completely understand that. But once again, I'm going to put the onus on us. What are we going to incentivize? What standard are we going to hold our officials to? And are we going to wait for their political calculations? Are we going to call them out when we see them making political calculations that put them in a bad situation or again hurt our discourse? I was glad to hear that I think he's being removed from some committees and things of that nature. The best thing for him to do would be to apologize and resign.
And Justin, and think about the invitations for pastors in this situation. I know I was in pastoral ministry for a number of years, and one of the tensions that pastors, I think, often deal with their constituency and their parishioners is wondering, can they talk about politics from the pulpit? Should they even engage? Because being part of the kingdom of Jesus involves a different set of transcendent eternal values that sometimes intersect with politics and sometimes don't. But is this situation an opportunity to really highlight what we've been talking about all morning and the idea of, in all forms, learning how to meet hate and learning how to meet division with love and grace and some of these concepts of the kingdom?
It does present an opportunity. And, you know, I'm not one of those people that says everything that happens in politics that's negative that a pastor must preach on it. That's not the first thing they need to preach about. So I'm hesitant to tell them what to preach about. But certainly we should understand that intersection. And when the opportunity arises and there's a clear violation of Christian principle, I think that's a good opportunity for a pastor to speak out and say, here's what we believe, and here's why this is unacceptable based on biblical principles.
And Justin, we have just about a minute left here. I'm curious your thoughts, too. If people begin to engage in the kind of process in which they begin to refuse meeting hate with hate or violence with violence, and they attempt to meet such things with grace and love and forgiveness, that doesn't just automatically mean that the response of the oppressor or the perpetrator of the violence is suddenly going to become positive. How do you stay in that journey for the long term, continuing to offer grace and forgiveness when there isn't change on the other side?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a commitment to being faithful to doctrine, right? I think it's, You know, as an Orthodox Christian, I think that comes with orthopraxy. And so it's not really a choice. Number one, I do have to respond to injustice, and I have to do it in a certain way. And if I'm going to be faithful, if I'm going to be, you know, have fidelity within the public square, then I have to address things with grace. Number two, and second to that, which is this is very much secondary, is that, again, responding with vitriol and all those things is not as productive as we think it is. I actually think that it's counterproductive. So as a Christian, you have to stay prayerful. You have to stay reading the Bible so you can keep perspective. And as long as you keep perspective, you will be able to have grace as you go about very serious political situations, holding people accountable, but remembering that we all deserve grace.
Well, Justin, certainly appreciate what you do to carving out space for kingdom values in the midst of the Republican and Democrat debates. And just continue to pray for your work and what you're up to. And thanks for your wisdom and insight this morning.
Thanks for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
Take a break here for some Breakpoint and bottom of the hour news. And in the last half of our second hour, I'll be joined by Eric Johnson, who's a professor of Christian psychology at Houston Baptist University. And Eric and I are going to talk about what it means to care for Christians with personality disorders. Well, our good friend and colleague, Carmen LeBurge, who's the host of Connecting Faith here as part of the Faith Radio Network, sure loves the Ark Encounter that is down in Kentucky. And I see that there's some headlines that the founder of the Ark Encounter is offering free admission to the park to educational groups. Ken Ham's offer to visit the life-size replica of Noah's biblical ark comes after what he calls bullying and intimidation of kids by atheist groups. For example, the Wisconsin-based Freedom From Religion Foundation has sent a letter to more than 1,000 districts and 5 states surrounding the Kentucky tourist attraction, and the letter says a field trip to the Ark would be unconstitutional. So given Carmen's advice and her support of the Ark, I think we're going to take our 5-child homeschool and see if we can get free admission here down in Kentucky. Yesterday, we were joined by Adam Carrington of Hillsdale College, professor of politics there on Faith Radio Mornings, and he discussed the government shutdown and some of its history and some of the implications moving forward.
Saturday might have been the day that it crossed that line to the longest shutdown that we've had on record, which really shutdowns haven't been a thing until really the 1980s, and they really weren't as big a news till the 1990s with the Gingrich versus Clinton shutdowns, for those old enough to remember those. But yeah, this is now the longest government shutdown, and that means we're going to practically we're going to start to see a lot more of a squeeze on government workers, a lot more of a squeeze on public services, and I think that's where you're going to start to see the real pressure mounting and see who's getting more pressure as far as ending the shutdown in some way.
I always appreciate Adam's perspective on the show and talking about politics from a Christian perspective. You can head to myfaithradio.com and search for our show from yesterday, and you can see quite a bit of what Adam had to say. And up next, we'll be joined by Eric Johnson, who's a professor of Christian psychology at Houston Baptist University. And I know one of the things that churches have had to begin to wrestle with over the last maybe 15, 20 years in particular is mental illness and mental health and personality disorders and how we come around our brothers and sisters in Christ who are trying to walk that journey out.
Parents have many responsibilities as they raise kids, but one of the most profound tasks is this: to train their children. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Over the years, I've begun to see the difference between teaching and training. Teaching involves the transfer of concepts, giving input, and plenty of correction. These aren't bad things, but I find that training in the teen years is a better model. In it, you're giving your child the opportunity to flex their decision-making muscles. You're not overly protecting them from the world. You're coaching them to thrive in it. The main purpose of training should be to get kids ready for the world they will live in, not the world that parents would like for them to live in. Are you training your child or just teaching your child?
Looking for more parenting wisdom? Go online to ParentingTodaysTeens.org or search for Parenting Today's Teens in your favorite app store.
Twenty minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, joined at this time by Eric Johnson, who is a professor of Christian psychology at Houston Baptist University. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
Great to have you on the program. I know one of the things that a lot of pastors are having to wrestle through these days is dealing with loved ones within families that are part of the congregation that might have some kind of mental illness or personality disorder. And what are some things that you're seeing just initially as we get into this topic with our listeners?
Well, it's more common than I think we think, or maybe we want to think. Depending on what diagnosis you're talking about, there's maybe as much as 25% of a typical congregation that has some pretty serious struggles of various kinds. The most extreme is something called schizophrenia, where it's just hallucinations, delusions. But that's only about 1% of the population. Severe depression, severe anxiety, and personality disorders. When you total that up, there's a significant minority in the church that are really struggling week to week.
Well, and I think, Eric, too, I mean, one of the values of our country is sort of this rugged individualism where we really value an ability to make it on our own and pull up our bootstraps and be victorious in all of those ways that we use. But that can bleed into the church pretty quickly. And it seems like it's one of those things that's hidden that families really don't want to bring out into the light because they're afraid of being seen as weak or imperfect or maybe even God is against them in some way.
Yeah, wow, you nailed a lot of the struggles that we have. I think, there's a natural tendency to in human beings, because we were created to be perfect, we have this natural tendency to hide our imperfections. And when you mix sin into that, it becomes a kind of a deadly mixture that because we're still broken sinners, even though Christ has saved us, we have that same tendency to hide, just as Adam and Eve hid their alienation in the garden. So what ends up happening is we kind of show up in church with the smiley face and how you doing, I'm doing fine, and we tend not to get into the harder stuff. But what better place to talk about that stuff, to get in small groups, to share our struggles than in the local church where Jesus is our healer and our savior, and he's the one that loves us.
Yeah, bearing each other's burdens is one of the hallmarks of the beloved community of faith, that we're called to do that for one another. And Eric, if a church wants to begin to engage in this process and begin to understand what's happening among their parishioners and to help families, there is a bit of a hurdle, it seems like, that we need to get over. And you referenced this in an article that you released, that there can be a quite a bit of skepticism and cynicism even about the field of psychology as it is relates to our faith. So what are some things we need to get over in terms of seeing psychology as even a God-centered tool?
Yeah. Well, it's complicated, and I totally respect those who are skeptical, because modern psychology is based in secularism, and there's no God in their theories, and so there's a right wariness of that. But by acknowledging that, then we can take a look and benefit from the scientific research and the valid theories that are done by people made in God's image. There's a whole doctrine in good theology called common grace, that we believe that God gives science to the human race, and it's ultimately it belongs to God, and so Christians need to claim that. And so the field of psychology, while at the core there's no God, a lot of at the periphery there's a lot of findings, research that can be immensely valuable for us as we seek to develop a God-centered approach to caring for souls.
I've heard the phrase from Dallas Willard where he talks about we live in a God-bathed world. And is it possible to look at sciences like psychology and even other sciences, Eric, as the idea that we're simply being able to better understand what is already a God-bathed world?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We begin with the belief, the assumption that God is in charge, and he's the creator of the whole universe, and he's the one that gives common grace for human beings to discover the order that he has established in that. So it's so appropriate. The founders of the scientific revolution were mostly Christians, and it's only been in the last 150 years that secularism took over the human sciences, and we have to reclaim that. It's a great time to reclaim that.
So families are looking to start trying to get some help for people within their families with personality disorders or different kinds of mental illnesses, and are willing to engage in some of the holistic process of it. What are some first steps they can take to move in that direction?
Well, you know, I think it's most about 60% of Christians, when they have a mental illness issue in their family or themselves, they go to their pastor, and I think that's a great first step. Pastors are kind of the first lines in God's mental health system, as it were, and just to, you know, to seek help, counsel, and then I think it's important for pastors to have a preliminary kind of you know, basic understanding of the field of mental illness, the kinds of things that can go wrong with people, and then to see themselves. My wish is that pastors would, in addition to all their other important responsibilities, to see themselves as sort of a referral person to be able to have some idea of the people in the local community, Christian counselors, psychiatrists that they can work with, and if there's no Christians in the area, even to work with non-Christians who are skilled and competent to help with severe problems, and then to refer their people out when the particular needs of the parishioner outstrip the knowledge base and skill level of the pastor. That's not a slam against pastors. That's a commendation of pastors and their unique role in helping their flock.
Yeah, certainly, Eric. I went through a Master's of the Divinity program to get my pastoral licensing, and so many of the things that we're facing today in some of the mental illness and personality disorders exceeded the scope of anything I would have learned in seminary. So we do really need to have a pretty robust response from a number of angles. And when we come back from break, I would love to get into that a little bit further with you in terms of what are some of these steps towards healing and wholeness, and that we can walk out this journey together. We're talking with Professor Eric Johnson this morning. He's released an article on Desiring God .org called Still Saints, Caring for Christians with Personality Disorders. More to come with Eric next on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are chatting with Eric Johnson this morning, who's a professor of Christian psychology at Houston Baptist University, and we're talking a bit about what it means to care for those around us that are going to be struggling with mental illness or personality disorders. And Eric, we were referencing before the break that this really does often exceed the scope of pastors doing their duties, and pastors do need to engage, but this healing is a pretty significant process in which to engage, and you talk about a three-dimensional approach. So maybe walk us through this and some of our listeners about some ways we can engage in these three dimensions.
Well, the one that the Bible most focuses our attention on is sin. And of course, sin is the greatest problem, you know, the greatest psychological disorder that we have. You know, it alienates us from our Creator, and therefore it has to be taken with the greatest seriousness. And Christ died for our sins and cleanses us from its power and forgives us from that. And so when we deal with problems, psychological problems, of course, sin is going to spill out. And in some cases, it's going to be especially obvious with people with certain kinds of disorders, like personality disorders. But we make a mistake if we think that's the only kind of problem that people struggle with. Because of the fall, our bodies are also damaged, and we grow up in fallen worlds, a fallen world, fallen families, and we're exposed to various kinds of abuse, some of us more than others. And that can leave its mark in our development distort our thinking, and our emotion systems can be damaged, and our relational patterns can be damaged. And so another kind of problem that the Bible hints at without going into a whole lot of detail is weakness, the biblical category of weakness that Paul especially focuses on in 2 Corinthians. A term that's used in psychology for weakness in this area would be biopsychosocial damage, and it's the way in which our brains and the structures of our relationship and our self-understanding can be so damaged. And there we want to surrender our damage to the Lord and encourage him to ask him and walk with him in a way that strengthens us and bring some measure of healing in this life, though we await full healing in the life to come. And then the other area that deals with suffering, that falls into psychological disorder, is suffering. And this is, of course, another mark of life in a fallen world. It can leave suffering in childhood, in particular, can leave its imprint deeply on our soul. So, in my experience, people who have chronic depression usually have experienced a significant loss in their life growing up in various ways. And as they emerge in adulthood, they find a deep sadness kind of wells up in them. Similarly, people who have severe anxiety grew up in a dangerous environment, either physically dangerous or emotionally dangerous, where they were constantly being criticized or whatever, and it gave them a heightened sense of anxiety that again emerges in adulthood. And so, to look at the whole of a person when in adulthood, we need to understand that sin is the dominant problem, the most serious problem, but there's also suffering that the person has experienced, and people who have severe disorders. There's usually biopsychosocial damage that haunts them, that the Christian community needs to be there to be able to try and help address all three components.
Yeah, I wrote down that phrase. It's one I'm unfamiliar, so I got to ask you more about it. But biopsychosocial damage. So are you suggesting, Eric, that all of us are impacted in some way because we live in a fallen world, and so none of us really are functioning in the way that we are intended, and it's really only in the kingdom that we find at least some measure of hope and healing in that?
Yeah. God, we were made for God to be the center of our lives, and so knowing Him as our Father, as our the lover of our souls, as our caregiver and shepherd, provides a kind of psychological ballast that enables us to cope with the problems of a fallen world. He's got to be the center, but we also need the human dimension. We were created for one another, and the church is also established by God to be a site where we can bear one another's burdens, and we can share and open up, hopefully in a safe, the church being a safe place where we're not attacked because of our problems, but we're invited to open up and to share. I think one of the key needs in our day is for churches. Well, while we need to hold high standards for what it means to follow Jesus, at the same time, we have to balance that with an equal sense that this is a grace-based community where people with brokenness and sin are welcomed, and that people feel a kind of an invitation to let down their guard and to be honest and transparent with one another. And I dream of churches more and more being like the Jesus who attracted broken sinners to Him. And so different from the Pharisees who chased them away.
Yeah, and certainly it's incumbent, at least on some level, on our shepherds and our pastors to create that kind of environment where people are welcomed that might be struggling with mental illness and personality disorder. And Eric, I hesitate to ask the question because we just have about 90 seconds left here, but I know it comes up in my classrooms quite often. People asking the question about, is there a spiritual warfare dimension to personality disorders and to mental illness that we need to attend to?
Yeah, I think we absolutely. It's a holistic model that Christianity recognizes. Satan and demons do infiltrate human life. They don't manifest themselves in the same way, I think, in the West as we see around the world in other communities. That's maybe a discussion for another day, why that's the case. But I think we have to be aware that we're dealing with spiritual forces that oppress people unbeknownst to us often, and we need to pray against them. And resist that presence that works with both spiritual forces, but also the flesh that we have in within us, and then the world, the spiritual pressures from our culture. So really, all three are operative, and we just have to be aware of those three dimensions all the time.
Yeah, Eric, I would certainly love to have you back on the program and talk just about that very fact, about why sometimes it seems like in Western culture our senses have been dulled to the realm of the spirit. So thanks for taking the time this morning, as you did, to walk us through some parts of this and to give some hope to families and people that are struggling with mental illness. If our listeners want to go read the article, just remind them again where they can go.
Yeah, that's at desiringgod.org, John Piper's website. And thanks, Eric. Been great talking with you.
Yeah, you too, Eric. Have a great week. We'll take a break here, and we'll wrap up our show for the 15th of January on Faith Radio Mornings. You know, Rachel, such an important topic. I know there's many people in all of our lives that are struggling with mental illness and trying to walk out this journey in a way, because it gets to be so shameful and so difficult to do. But you wrote a blog on the subject.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a little bit from personal experience and finding ways to talk about it and really discuss with people openly, because I think the more I talk with people, the more I realize that everyone deals with some sort of, you know, mental illness, or they have someone in their life who has. And so it's really an important conversation to have.
Yeah, really, as I find myself in many Christian rooms, just sort of trying to break down the assumptions that I have that people aren't struggling with anything, when the vast majority of people in any room are going to be struggling with something. So thanks for the work that you did. Thanks for booking the guests that you and Paul do, like Eric, that can walk us through some of these topics. And looking forward to you as listeners joining us again tomorrow on Faith Radio Mornings, where we'll continue to fix our eyes on Jesus together.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.